Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, theology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour on this June the 23rd on the West Coast, June the 24th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone, and everywhere east of the East Coast of the United States, around the rest of the world. Welcome all of you who may be listening in Russia, or in Scotland, Ireland, England, France, Germany, maybe even in Kenya someone's listening by now. Hopefully they're listening in Hawaii, too. Got something interesting to share before we bring tonight's guest up, and we may talk about this for a moment or two. As my listening audience and many of my readers know, visitors to my website, folks that read my research, which has been published in the Idaho Observer, I have been working on part 7 of the Three Stooges Go to Washington, which is an encapsulation, a review, and some new material on this mystery person sitting in the White House. No one knows even what planet he's from, let alone where he's from on the Earth. And I believe I've tracked that down from the outset, actually, but I went along with the flow of everyone else, following the Hawaii story, and we were taken from Hawaii to Kenya with Phil Berg's lawsuit, Jerome Corsi's book, and his investigation there, and we have an audio recording of his alleged grandmother, Kezia. Actually, I wonder if it's possible to have, well, I don't know. I guess, you know, it's like if somebody has four wives, do you have four grandmothers on that side of the family? Anyway, one of the grandmothers, Kezia, swears that she was at the birth in Kenya. So if that's true, then the birth did not occur in Hawaii. And if the Hawaii birth is true, then the birth did not occur in Kenya. Well, there seems to be in that what's called the Hegelian dialectic, this duplicity used by communists and fascists and the like, especially the secret societies. Black is white, white is black. And so instead of looking at cities, let's look at people and let's consider those two premises that I just gave you. And in the process of putting together all of the facts that I have gathered, and either published or am about to publish, because, this is a piece which is unfolding. When it's written for a newspaper, but is becoming a book, obviously I can't, come up with all the facts at the same moment. Otherwise, I should just sit back and do all the research and then write the book. But this is important enough to bring it out. We're talking about saving a country, possibly saving the world. And I'm not saying I'm the savior. I'm talking about us arriving at the truth and taking action upon the information that we have. Because we have an illegal person creating laws, sending people to their death in wars, sending people to their death by mandating vaccinations and all kinds of horrific technology that's being targeted on unsuspecting and knowing persons who have been abused for major parts of their lives. And so it warrants bringing the truth out. And you got to be able to think outside the box. These people are operating outside of the box and expecting us to stay inside the box like we have for the past 230 or so years. And that's changing. And they have a hard time coping with the fact that we're getting smarter, we're raising our consciousness, and in the process of doing that, the truth is coming out. And they can't cope with that because they can't keep lying and have their lies dispelled by the light that comes out with the truth. Now, in the process of looking for some more facts to add to my story, or searching for things such as photos, I stumbled upon another Stanley Armour, Madeline Dunham, Olin Mills type creation. Now, Olin Mills, for the younger people in the listening audience, is a chain of photography shops around the country that do great photography work, and they're very good at touching up skin blemishes on high school graduates and folks that are getting their prom pictures or their graduation pictures. And they've moved into the family photo arena, and now with Photoshop and other computer programs, you can completely circumvent these companies that have traditionally done stellar work in the area of producing family photos. And reasonably priced and timely and professionally done. Now, when you take people who are not in a photograph and put them in a photograph, it's not the same thing as snapping the shutter of a camera. And I stumbled across a picture related to the alleged death of the alleged grandmother of Barack Obama, Madeline Dunham. And this picture is Stanley Armour and Madeline Dunham in a somewhat awkward-looking pose for a camera. One's looking at the camera, and one's turned 90 degrees away from the camera. And somebody's taking the picture. Now, before I get into the details about that photograph, and this will be in the new article, this picture is so absurd, you wonder what drugs the person that did the work in Photoshop on this photo was on. And the house in the background of this picture is an amalgamation of three or four different architectural styles, and the house is leaning at about 22.5 degrees to the right, in other words, the right side of the house, which you can't see the entire part of, is actually it's either going over the edge of a cliff or it's in the ground. Let's put it that way. The house is so off kilter. And so I straightened the house, and now the porch is out of alignment. And as I studied the porch, it looks like the porch was constructed much like the characters in the photo. Stanley Armour is wearing a very raggedy-looking army uniform. Doesn't have a tie that one can see. The collar seems to disappear. It's got lapels in the front, but then the collar disappears. His head is, and his neck is cropped on. In fact, I'm not even sure that it matches other photos of Stanley Armour. It's someone who sort of looks like him, but he's got the prototypical white walls about a half an inch above and around his ears. That's a haircut where you see nothing but skin in between the ear and where the hair begins. Usually, I don't think it's that drastic of a cut. Certainly out of style for the day. What's more out of style is the hat that he's wearing. He's wearing an army uniform, and he's wearing a Marine hat. It's a Marine hat. And I checked this out with a good friend who is former, if you're listening, Drew, don't get mad, Drew Raines, former U.S. Marine Corps, saw that hat and immediately knew that was a Marine hat. It's got the chin strap up above the bill, and there are no insignias whatsoever on the Army uniform, and he's also wearing a Marine belt. So whoever put this photo together really didn't know what they were doing. The hat and the hairdo and the back of the head of Stanley Armour is cut, it appears, with an X-Acto knife. This photo has the name Hawaii in a long digit I won't trouble the listening audience with, but I've nicknamed this the Hawaiian X-Acto knife photo. Also, Madeline has an X-Acto knife hairdo at her hair forehead, where the forehead meets the hairline. It looks, upon enlargement, as if someone took an X-Acto knife and cut out someone's hair and put it on top of that face. Neither image of this alleged photo of Stanley Yarmer nor Madeline Dunham look like the photo that I published recently in my photo analysis, part six of the Three Stooges Go to Washington. And there's a little bit of resemblance, but from picture to picture, these people look like they've been replaced. I mean, either these are clones or they're just trying to find something that sort of resembles the other person. The fingers are too long. The arms are too long. You've got elbows that go way down past the person's waist. Of course, in this particular case, the torso is probably 6 to 12 inches too short. Imagine pulling your pants up to your armpits. That's how ridiculous this photograph looks. Pants are creased in the front and raggedy in the back. Just too many anomalies. Even the shrubbery in the photo looks like it's photoshopped. And you can actually see faces in the photo. Even Drew Raines remarked that he sees an image in this. And many times we've seen anomalies in these photographs. So without further ado, I'm going to bring tonight's guest on board, and we're going to talk about this and some of the other anomalies briefly, but we've got two major topics that we want to discuss that we've attempted to wrap up in the past two appearances. Our guest is a researcher, journalist, a webmaster of one of the most popular sites in the world, educate-yourself.org, and he's an inventor of sorts, and my good friend, Mr. Ken Adachi. Ken, welcome to the show.
Hi, Don. Thank you so much for having me back again. It's always a pleasure to be on with you.
Well, it's nice to have you here. Now, you got to hear me talk about these this new photo that I found.
Yeah.
What's your impression?
Yes,
am I exaggerating anything here?
No, I was studying the photo while you were doing the intro. I can certainly, first, the completely illicitness of a Marine hat on a man who's supposed to be in the Army, that doesn't fly. Now, the type of belt that he's wearing is typical of a military belt. Typically the Army, particularly at that time, I guess in World War II, it probably would have been dark brown, I'm guessing. And of course it's a black and white photo. The Air Force didn't even exist at the time. You just had what was called the Army Air Corps during the Second World War.
Yeah.
And the Air Force, came into existence around 1947, 49, I'm not sure. It was called the Air Force. They had a blue belt, and depending on the uniform, whether it's a dress or what type of uniform it is, the Marines have a couple different colored belts, depending whether they're in dress or not. So I can't say whether the belt might not be Army, but what makes no sense at all is a hat. Now, I'm not an expert on this. I would actually have to look at books that had uniforms from the World War II. My memory is that the strap across the top of the hat above the bill is not an Army thing. I don't recall that at all. Definitely a Marine thing. But I'd actually have to look. But now getting back to other oddities, that first the angle of their bodies in the house is not quite logical. Now,
that's an understatement.
Yeah. As I was studying the railing and the porch and the clapboard in the background, I do notice they are parallel. And of course, you can't see any steps of the porch. And I noticed the gap between the bottom of the rail and the porch deck, the flooring of the porch, is parallel. So I'll say that, but it's the angle of the house to the angle of their body doesn't make sense. It's, they would, of course, be standing up, you know, vertically. They wouldn't be leaning in this photo, and yet the house, it's tilted in respect to the angle of their body. So that looks odd. Now, the length of the left arm, the upper arm, if you start at the top of the uniform and go to what appears to be the length of the upper arm seems too long. You would expect the elbow to occur at an earlier point in the picture than it does, and it looks odd. The length of the upper arm of the left arm is too long, mm-hmm. and the fingers, well, they look, well, he was a big person, so it's possible, but
yeah, we have other shots of his fingers though in
mm-hmm.
other photos.
Oh, and, oh, I see. Okay.
And one's fingers don't get smaller as they go through life.
No, yeah. No. Now, in terms of shadows, what I'm seeing here, what doesn't make any sense, the light is coming from above. They're outside. It's a daytime shot. You can see from the shadows that the house is creating because there's an overhang on the porch. You can see that the light is obviously above them, and his left shoulder is quite light in contrast. It's mm-hmm. as if the sun was hitting it.
Mm-hmm.
Why the left side of his face would have any shadow doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, zooming his in, you'll head, notice he has leprosy, too. I forgot to mention that.
Right. The roughness of the skin and what looks like a darkening of the skin, that is not natural. That skin of his left face should be in full light. You can see that his head is casting something of a shadow on her, the left side of her face, the
in
upper
the,
left side.
Yeah, in the sunlight.
Yeah, so his face should not, so that's odd. And the other thing I got to remark is I definitely see what look like entity creatures in the shrubbery.
Yes.
There's a number of them, as you said.
Yes. Now, I forgot to mention the beach chairs that are on the porch.
Yeah.
And because those were inserted in a layer, if you look carefully at the railing, you'll notice the railing doesn't look real. You see, they had to take the railing out or whatever was on that porch, put those chairs in, and reconstruct the railing in the photograph.
Mm-hmm.
It looks almost like a drawing, mm-hmm. if you get my meaning. You don't see three-dimensionality at all mm-hmm. in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you might be right on that, yeah.
Oh, I know I'm right. I've spent enough time looking at it. There were also many anomalies on the window. You know, it's a very, very strange setting. Now, I would say that house was in the northern Midwest. It could be in the Chicago area. It could be in Ohio. Certainly, it is not Hawaii.
No, no way.
And I know the architecture, and I can tell you that porch is representing, I'm not even saying that belongs with that house, but it represents circa 1925 to 1927 architecture. I know of houses that have that tongue and groove pine flooring that usually is painted to protect it, and it warps over a certain period of time. And that warped early on. That warped in less than 20 years. So it wasn't well taken care of. It's in a very anomalous situation. You see no greenery that resembles anything in Hawaii, and yet they labeled the picture Hawaii as if...
Oh, that's right. They labeled it Hawaii, yeah.
Okay. So I'm wondering if this came out of the health department sealed records, you know? it's just so ridiculous. It's another ridiculous photo, but I upon examining it, within less than 30 seconds, I found all of these anomalies I'm describing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They just
yeah,
stick
what's
up
very it. Odd is his left arm when you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
There is no way it's the upper portion of the arm is too long in comparison to the lower forearm. It's just too long.
Now, Barack Obama has a longer left leg. We saw that in the Central Park photo. It's 6 inches longer up to the knee than his right leg.
Mm-hmm.
That's because of Photoshop, okay? Right. When you're manipulating these figures, you even have to detach body parts and try to reconstruct them. Mm-hmm. And I would say a person like that would get an F in art class just because that's the lowest grade you're allowed to give. certainly this photo is far worse than any of the other ones that we've seen so far. Do you see the X-Acto knife feature that I'm describing both?
I see what you're saying. I mean, I understand what you're saying. I don't know whether, you know, that's, I can't say one way or the other, but I certainly see what you're talking about. But it's indisputable. The left arm is too odd. The shadowing of the face and what appears to be a ruddy complexion doesn't make sense. And a darkened, he's in the shadows. That makes no sense, considering the lighting condition.
Mm-hmm. So, well, they do that to mask the compilation. You know,
yeah,
the layering.
Right. Yeah, I understand that. So, yeah. I've enlarged it. I'm looking at an enlarged version of it now. At least in two or three times enlarged, it has that feeling, you know, like you discovered with the basketball team photo.
Uh-huh.
The depth of doesn't look right between him and her. It looks as if he was inserted on top of her image. It just had a depth. When you don't see this at the small, but when you enlarge it two or three times from its original size, the depth of field doesn't look right at all. It looks unnatural. It looks as if it's been added on top of hers. Her image was already there, then they added his on top of that. That I can kind of see.
Now, don't you find it strange that he's sort of facing a 90-degree angle to the direction of the shutter, you know, the camera?
Yeah, well, no, I'll in defense of you, it's certainly possible he could be in that type of pose at that move. You know, in other words, he's not panning, he's not doing a smile cheese for the camera type deal.
Well, he's not even looking at the camera.
I understand that, but he's more or less, he's hugging her and he's focused more on that rather than she's looking at the camera.
We've come to the conclusion that this is totally fabricated, so obviously they're not trying to reveal too much, or they couldn't reveal too much, because they didn't have a genuine picture. So it's, you know, the reason it looks like it is because that's the only way they could create it. and a pretty lousy job. Now, if you look at her forehead, you can see she has the same X-Acto knife look that he has on the back of his head. In fact, the hat and the hair are two separate layers. And putting the hat on there, they didn't quite align it properly. When you put on a baseball cap and you have certain thickness to your hair doesn't hang. I've yet to see a person whose hair hangs like an X-Acto knife. Until life's, like it was cut with an X-Acto knife. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean lengthwise, I mean flat in the back, as if he's leaning up against the window, you know, and that would cause it to take the shape of the window pane.
I just might mention to you, I've enlarged it probably more than you have. I'm looking at their face, and what pops out is that across her forehead, when you enlarge it, she seems to have what looks like a cross about the middle of her forehead running from left to right, you know. It looks as if she has what look like you could describe as a series of stitches, as if there was a scar across her face and it was a series of stitches there. And that's odd. In his left cheek seems to be two vertical dark lines as well. They're parallel to each other, as if he had a serious scratch across his left cheek. That mm-hmm. really stands out when you enlarge the photo. So I'm sort of wondering.
It almost looks like a birthmark, doesn't it? Or
almost, yeah. It looks like two parallel lines on his face, as if his face had been, you know,
clawed.
Scratched.
Yeah.
Yeah, clawed, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And oddness across her forehead. Again, giving the lighting doesn't make sense. The right side of her head is supposedly in sunlight. What's accounting for that? I have no idea.
Well, you know, the sunlight would lighten her up. It would not create a shadow outside mm-hmm. like that, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And if you look at how abnormal his shirt is, mm-hmm. they lighten the color of the shirt. I've not retouched the contrast or anything on mm-hmm. this photo. You look at his arm, you see some very unnatural... you know, his arm looks like an X-Acto knife had cut it. His shoulder, the back of his hair, his neck, each segment looks like it was cut with an X-Acto knife. And his collar literally disappears. Why would his back be all lit up like that?
Yeah, right.
You know, when the side of the house, which is in front of him, is very bright. And the mm-hmm. part near his back is the darkened portion of the porch,
mm-hmm.
you see? Mm-hmm. So for the listening audience who's trying to follow what we're saying, this is just absolutely ridiculous what we're looking at. And you mm-hmm. will see it in the mm-hmm. Three Stooges Go to Washington, Part 7. Also, look at the middle finger of the right hand.
That's quite long, yes, right.
Not just long. Do you see the difference in color?
There's a difference in the last digit, yeah, right. Is that dark, as if he had one of those, like, rubber covers people put on for paper, you know, when you're handling paper or something like that.
That's Stanley the Proctologist.
Yeah, that is odd, and again, that's in full sunlight. There's no reason that should be dark like that.
Yes, and...
Right.
And I tell you,
that's against a white background. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. I may have erred in saying that the white walls around the ears are half an inch. They're probably an inch. it's just utterly ridiculous, this whole photo. This is insane.
Mm-hmm.
And that they put this out, this is in the tribute piece to his so-called grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And we have conflicting information now. Maya Satoru Ng, the alleged stepsister of Barack Obama, now says that Madeline Dunham lived in Hawaii since 1959. Well, the published story has always been 1960.
Okay.
Now we have more conflicting information. Mm-hmm. And is it Koalani Hospital? That's where the birth took place, according to her. So mm-hmm. Of course, the hospitals have no records of such a birth.
Mm-hmm.
And they would not, because he was not born there.
Right.
And I'm telling the listening audience, he was not born in Kenya. Get that right out of your minds.
Right.
Okay? You're going to be brought up to speed.
Right.
And this picture just fortifies all the work I've done in one fell swoop. It just... underscores the fraudulent nature of this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
If I was having a nightmare, I couldn't create something like this
mm-hmm.
in a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
There are just so many anomalies in here. It looks like he has a Zippo lighter attached to his left arm, too, underneath the elbow, if you look at it. Something really strange. It's like a string attached to something on his shirt that goes back behind, underneath what looks like a wallet in the back left pocket of his pants.
Oh, yes, I see what you're saying.
It looks like a rope, actually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I see what you're saying there, yeah.
No, this is all effect. And if you look at the belt and the pants are not even meeting the belt. You see her dress in between the belt and the pants underneath the belt, if you look closely. There's
mm-hmm.
a gap. You see
mm-hmm.
that? Totally photoshopped. absolutely, mm-hmm. totally photoshopped onto here. He's got a pocket that goes from the front of his shirt underneath his armpit.
Let's see.
Look at the pocket.
I'm looking at the pocket, right.
It goes so underneath the arm.
Right, right, you're right. Mm-hmm. The width of the pocket,
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a little bit strange. That's wider than you would think it would be, yeah.
this whole thing is just a fraud. No one's fingers are that long.
Mm.
No one's. Even Wilt Chamberlain didn't have, or Bill Russell didn't have fingers that long. Well, okay. Well, I think we've got a quick call, but
let's pass on the calls.
I don't want to move off topic here. And,
right, exactly.
I want to keep it on point here. So,
right.
Ron, if you're listening to us, call us on an appropriate night when we're on that particular topic, if you would. Okay, Ken, you and I have been discussing, we're going to shift gears here now, the Jeffrey McDonald case. And I know you wanted to bring forth some more information, so I'm going to allow you to do that, and we have another point that we want to get to as well.
Okay, well, we'll see what we have time for. I just wanted to pick up where I had left off last week. I was covering the Jeffrey McDonald case. Just a very quick recap. We're talking about a man by the name of Dr. Jeffrey Robert McDonald, who railroaded, really, with an absolutely set up, prearranged trial in 1979. His wife and his two young children were murdered on February 17th of 1970. And within just a matter of a couple months of the murder, on an Army base, Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and the Army focused their list of suspects down to one person, the husband of the wife and the father of the children. And as it turns out, the people involved in the Army Criminal Investigation Division, some of those individuals who actually conducted the murder investigation were aware of the persons who were in the house that night and had committed the murder and were involved with them in illicit activity. And they needed to not have a genuine investigation. So the first thing the Army CID did was to fight for exclusive investigative authority over the case, because the FBI, when the case first broke, wanted to be part of the investigation, but the Army did not want that to happen, because they wanted to keep a lid and they wanted to control the evidence, etc. And long story short, they went through an Army hearing in the late summer of 1970. They accused McDonald of the murder. After a three-month hearing, he was exonerated completely by the Army hearing. The fellow in charge of the hearing, a guy named Colonel Rock, had said that all the charges against McDonald were simply untrue. And he saw through completely the duplicity and the falsity of the Army CID's attempt to essentially frame McDonald. And McDonald went on the Dick Cavett show in December of that same year. He was disparaging of the Army CID people for trying to hang the crime on him. And the story goes is that the Army, therefore, decided on a vendetta against McDonald, and they proceeded to set into motion a great deal of players to eventually indict him for the murder, which they did in 1975. And then it took another 4 years for the case to go to trial, which occurred in August of 79. McDonald was found guilty, given 3 consecutive life sentences. So I covered the main aspects of the case last week. People who want to know the case can begin by reading the overview of my website, but there's a great deal of documentation at McDonald's own website. It's maintained by his wife, Catherine McDonald, and it's called the McDonaldcase.org. And if you want the best documentation on the case, it's found at that site. Now, there's a book that was published in 1995 called Fatal Justice by two authors, Jerry Potter and Fred Bost, B-O-S-T, that tell the true story of what happened in the McDonald case and how he was railroaded and framed by the Army and then later by the Justice Department. And they don't offer the sort of theories that I offer on my website, because my website is more geared towards the revelations that Ted Gunderson, ex-FBI bureau chief Ted Gunderson, had evolved over the years. He was looking into the case since 1979, when he went to see McDonald in prison shortly after the trial, and has been working the case ever since. In fairness, a local Fayetteville detective by the name of Prince Beasley turned up an extremely valuable person to review details about the story. Her name was Helena Stokely. I mentioned her in a bit of detail last time. Anyway, Helena Stokely really told the story of what happened. She said her and the members of her company were inside the house that night. They were involved in murdering the wife and the 2 children. And she also revealed that members of the CID were involved, were in cahoots with the drug trafficking, as well as some members of the Fayetteville police. And she said that there was a huge drug pipeline extending from Vietnam into various military bases in the United States. This murder occurred in early 1970, and of course we were right in the middle of the Vietnam War, which ran from roughly 65 approximately to 75. And she says they were, this group that she was affiliated with, were part of what was a CIA operation. They were putting drugs in bags into the body cavities of some returning GIs, and then the drugs were removed from the body cavities and the body cavities sewn up, and then the body was delivered to the parents or its final destination, etc. Mm-hmm. They were delivering a great deal of drugs without obviously any interdiction, any inspection, etc. So had they had a genuine investigation, and if they undoubtedly they would have caught the members of the coven, because this detective Prince Beasley knew the day of the murder when he heard a description of McDonald's description of the assailants. He instantly knew it was Helena Stokely and her group. He knew it. He confronted her that very evening, and she almost admitted the whole thing to him. She admitted, you know, easily 95% of the story to him right there. She felt a great deal of remorse because the children were killed. Okay, so what had happened is that a series of appeals were attempted following McDonald's conviction, and he had judges in the case, and particularly the prosecution, which is from the very beginning, starting even with post the Army hearing. A fellow who was in the Army at the time, Brian Murtaugh, left the Army and joined the Department of Justice, or was arranged for him to go into the Department of Justice, and he picked up this prosecution of McDonald from that point to this very day. Brian Murtaugh is still the prosecutor in this case, 38, 39 years after the murder. This normally doesn't happen, but this man has been, this is my opinion, this man has been assigned to this case to see to it that McDonald never gets out, because the last thing they want to see happen is the truth to come out about, A, the participants, the true participants in the murder, and B, why the Army had gone through such lengths to frame and railroad McDonnell as the patsy for the crime.
And you're talking about the drug smuggling.
Drug smuggling. So yeah. It's a great deal of Army brass on Fort Bragg at the time, according to Helena Stokely, a number of Army brass, up to and including two generals, it went that high, were in on the loop of the drug, you know, distribution and all that, were knowledgeable about it, etc. So there's no way the Army was going to allow a genuine investigation, because had these people been taken into custody, they would have sang. They normally do. If they offer them a deal of immunity, they sing. And that would have happened, and that would have opened up this entire, you know, CIA operation and the corrupt individuals who were responsible for, you know, who were behind this frame-up and railroading. So there's no way they're going to allow that to happen.
Now, okay. All these people you're talking about, Ken, are now conspirators in this whole thing.
Well,
wouldn't you say even the prosecutor and the judge?
Oh, definitely. If you read Fatal Justice, it's a very thoroughly researched book. It took those two men 10 years to produce that book. They did their homework. Because there was an author by the name of Joe McGinnis who wrote a novel, a work of fiction called Fatal Vision. It took him 4 years to write it between 1979 and 1983. He had full access to all of McDonald's personal files, information, his friends, etc. McDonald was led to believe by this individual called Joe McGinnis, who ought to be, you know, one of these award winners of these Hall of Shame type characters, had misled McDonald, believed that he was writing a book that would exonerate him. That was the original point of hiring him on to cover the story. McDonald thought he was going to be acquitted, and he wanted to essentially document the trial and etc. expected, and because he was declared guilty, the publisher of a guy named Lord, I believe his last name is Lord, Sterling Lord, I believe his name was involved in setting up, played a role. I think he was the agent for McGinnis. I might have my facts wrong, but. McGinnis had
handler, maybe is a better word.
well, he was. I think he was some sort of agent. Literary agent. McGinnis already had quite a reputation at that point in time because he had wrote another successful book. I can't remember the name of it. It might have to have to do with the Kennedy years. I'm not sure. However, this fellow, McGinnis had been given an advance on this book of $250,000, and now the trial results in a guilty verdict, and he was going to. The theme of the book was they were going to exonerate and show how the Army had framed this man. So the publisher who put up this $250,000 said, we're not going to sell a lot of copies now that he's been declared guilty. I want my money back. And McGinnis, working with this fellow Sterling Lord, I guess, struck a new deal, and they said, well, let's change the plot. Now we're going to go from an innocent McDonald to a guilty McDonald. And he changed the title. The original title was supposed to be Acid and Rain. It was changed to Fatal Vision. And he just now manufactured this, Jekyll and Hyde type psychotic killer out of whole cloth, out of his imagination. Mm-hmm. He just made up stuff and loaded this book up and pretended to the whole world as if it was based on fact. And at the time, a large portion of the country believed that book, believed the miniseries movie that followed the following year, four-part miniseries followed in 1984. And therefore, millions of people became convinced of McDonald's guilt, the same way millions of people became convinced of O.J.'s guilt after his trial, including myself at the time. at the time of the trial, I come to find out that that guy was set up too. He didn't have a damn thing to do with murdering his wife or that man, Ron Goldman. But that's another story. Anyway, McDonald was absolutely fried in the public opinion because of this fiction writer, Joe McGinnis, and his betrayal of him. And in 1986 or 87, I can't remember the year exactly, McGinnis's defense team McDonald's defense team on behalf of McDonald sued McGinnis and won in court. They proved in court that he had manufactured a number of things in the book. He just manufactured them. He didn't have any proof of anything. And yet, in the 1979 trial, they use, many of the themes that...
were in the book.
Were in the book. I mean, the book came out after the trial, but they, McGinnis helped, create this fiction that they used in the book.
I think the whole approach to counter what they said, and, it's very easy for them when they're that corrupt to bring forth false witness, professional witnesses or just people that, that they have something on. They say, look, you're going to go into court and you're going to say this or else, and it could be, losing probation or being charged, being set up the same way, railroaded into jail.
Well, you've just said something very important because the earlier attempts at appeal were essentially blocked and by the presiding judge in the case from the very was a man named Judge Dury, and he remained in that position until his death. And then another judge, who's a close friend and associate, a guy named Judge Fox, took over as the presiding judge to this day. And what happened in 2005 is that there was a former U.S. Marshal by the name of Jimmy Britt, who was retired, but he was assigned to guard witnesses and so forth, and he was at the 1979 trial, and he was assigned to guard a woman, Helena Stokely, the gal I mentioned earlier, who admitted to Ted Gunderson, Prince Beasley, a number of her mother, a number of people that her group was responsible for the murder, and gave a great deal of detail of what happened to the in the house that night. And Jimmy Britt was in a room with then prosecutor, North Carolina State Prosecutor James Blackburn. He and U.S. Attorney Brian Murtaugh were the co-prosecuting attorneys on the case. Okay, mm-hmm. So you had Brian Murtaugh from the Department of Justice, and you had James Blackburn representing the state of North Carolina in the case. Okay, those were the two co-prosecutors. James Blackburn took the lead throughout the trial to present the case and et cetera. However, the actual person directing the action was certainly Brian Murtaugh. Okay, Jimmy Smith was with Helena Stokely when she was in the room with James Blackburn, and she wanted to explain on the stand what happened that night. She wanted immunity, though. Because obviously she didn't want to implicate herself in a murder. But she was willing to talk. Blackburn was not at all willing to give her immunity, but he went beyond that. And here's where he committed a major prosecutorial crime and felony. He threatened her with a murder indictment if she dared said anything on the stand that supported McDonald's innocence. So when she actually got on the stand and was asked the questions, she says, I can't remember, I don't remember what happened that night, etc. And she said after the trial that it was because of Blackburn's threat that he was going to indict her for murder that she couldn't say anything. Now, here you had a U.S. Marshal who was a witness to this crime.
Even though indicting her for murder was probably the proper thing, other than the fact that she was willing to talk. But, I mean, when you think about the ridiculous nature of what you're describing, you know.
But wait a minute, that's witness tampering. Helena yeah. Stokely was subpoenaed at the trial to be a witness. And that's witness tampering of the mm-hmm. most, you know, grave type. He's threatening her with a murder indictment if she says anything on the stand that supports, that's against the law. That's a major prosecutorial crime. And Brits witnessed it. Now, naturally, Helena said that she, but her word in terms of court, in terms of Judge Dupree, all, her words are worth nothing. She's an extra drug addict, blah, blah, blah. She has no standing. I mean, he just did everything that he can to marginalize and disgrace her in every way he could. Everything that came out of his mouth was disparaging of her.
Mm-hmm.
But you had Jimmy Brits, and you had this Judge Fox. Jimmy Brits said this in 2005. He was already retired. He was dying of cancer. Him and the mother of Helena Stokely contacted Catherine McDonald. They said, Jimmy Brits says, you know, I'm going to give you an affidavit. This is what happened. I witnessed this. And then Helena Stokely's mother, well, it was a younger brother of Helena Stokely, contacted Catherine McDonald and said, listen, you know, Helena told everything to my mother, and mother's is, you know, well, she's going. I'd like you to work. Catherine McDonald got in her car every evening.
Ken, if I can interrupt you for a second, you're breaking up a bit. You might want to close an extra program or two. So you're not eating up all your RAM.
Okay, let me do that as I'm talking to you.
Or your co-processor, I should say.
Okay. And, okay, so Catherine McDonald went down to North Carolina. This was trying to remember the year, and I believe it was in 2007. Because I think I got the timing right. Jimmy Britt and the mother of Helena Stokely died in the same year, which I believe was 2007. A judge had the opportunity to move on the Jimmy Brits affidavit in 2005, but he said he needed time to study it. He delayed for 3 years, so maybe Jimmy passed on in 2008. Maybe I've got the year off by 1 year. Right after Jimmy Brits had died, and Helena Stokely's mother had already died as well, Judge Fox ruled that he's not going to allow the Brits affidavit to be the basis for obtaining, you know, to open the door for yet another appeal. And fortunately, McDonald's defense team turned to the Fourth Circuit Court, who's a very, what I'm told is the most conservative, you know, appeals court in the country. Because of a change of personnel in these, you know, 39 years since the murder, they overruled the decision of this local Judge Fox, who's sitting on this case, and issued something called a Certificate of Appealability, abbreviated a COA. And this has now opened up a huge opportunity for the McDonald defense team. And they're moving on this, what was called an amicus filed by a group that is attempting to assist the McDonald defense team. There's a group, I think his name is Barry Sheck, if I got the name right. He might have been involved a bit in the OJ trial.
He's a DNA attorney.
Right. Because it does, McDonald's defense team, since I believe 95, either 95 or 97, somewhere in that, had started the ball rolling to get DNA, and they, because they had found DNA under the fingernails of the wife and under the fingernails of one of the child that did not, it was hair and part of skin, that did not match McDonald's. And, of course, the Murtaugh prosecutorial team had done everything in their power through the years to keep the defense aware of a great deal of laboratory evidence that would have cleared. It's called exculpatory evidence, in which it would have definitely demonstrated that McDonald, there was more people in the house that night than McDonald. The evidence proved it. But Murtaugh and his team had done such a terrific job of blocking everybody, and they even attempted to block this amicus, which is just, you know, an outside group attempting to participate in a, as a friend of the court, as it were, to add information that could help, you know, establish the man's, you know, innocence. Now, normally, prosecutors don't go out of their way to block this. Murtaugh did. And the reasons he put up, all this information is on the McDonald website, which is themcdonaldcase.org. Mm-hmm. Go to there, go to the document page. You can see everything that transpired from 2005 until the current moment, beginning with the Jimmy Britt's breakthrough, because that was a breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
I found out about that, I wrote a brief article about it, I put it on Rents. I thought that was going to start the ball rolling for his clearance right then and there, but what they did is that the judge, this Judge Fox, simply did not act on it, and he knew Jimmy Britt was dying of cancer, and he just allowed the man to die.
Mm-hmm.
And now, then he made a ruling within days after the man passed. So you can see that there is definitely less than, interest in truth and justice on the part of the people involved in this conspiracy to railroad this man. Now, the McDonald team isn't saying that. I'm saying that, but it's clear to me and anyone who looks at the evidence that from the beginning, this man has been victimized by the most horrendous case of, you know, judicial misconduct probably in the history of the country.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I remember correctly, I think last week when you were on the show, you described Brian Murtaugh as a rookie just out of, you know, law school or whatever.
Well, he was a young captain. He's approximately, roughly the same age as McDonald. He might be a couple years older, but McDonald's currently 65. Dr. McDonald's about 65 and a half today. And I'm guessing Murtaugh, but he's somewhere in the same age range, maybe 66, 67. So at the time, of the 1970, Jeffrey McDonald was 26 years old. So Murtaugh was probably around 26 or 27 himself. He got involved in the case immediately after the hearing. He wasn't part of the hearing. Other elements of the Army CID at North Carolina, Peter Kearns, William Ivory, who was the lead investigator, were a man named Proctor, who was the prosecutor in the case. But after this Dick Cavett show in December of 1970, apparently Murtaugh was called in. He was in the Army at the time. Was called in to coordinate this, you know, attempt now to reindict, reignite McDonald. So
don't you find that unusual that someone's career is devoted
absolutely
solely to that one case?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the fact that he, you know, was a young man, you would expect perhaps he would have had a career in the Army, and now he quickly left the Army because McDonald himself had gotten out of the Army. I don't know, somewhere he finished up this hearing. I think it was in early October. He was probably out of the military by late October, early November. And he did the Dick Cavett show a month and a half later. I think it was on December 7th or something like that. So he had just gotten out of the military 4 or 5 weeks. Now, you know, there's laws. You know, the Posse Comitatus Act does not allow the military to go after civilians. That's precisely what they did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is no end to the law-breaking and the illicit, it's a persecution.
Now, at what stage did Judge 666 come into the picture?
Well,
and I use that name intentionally because that's what Fox is in numerology.
So he came in after the passing of Judge Dupree. Judge Dupree was a rather, I'm not sure exactly the age, but I believe he was in his 80s.
How many years ago would you say that's been?
Again, it'll be on the McDonald site. I'm going to guesstimate at this point that it was somewhere in the 90s. I'm going to guesstimate probably 92, 93, 94, 95. I'm guesstimating, but probably somewhere in that range is when Fox came in to be take over from Dupree as the presiding judge. Because Dupree stayed on forever. I mean, the man, you know, was in there for a long time. And he had this close associate, Judge Fox, and who took over the case. And what's most unusual and totally out of what normally transpires, you don't have the same prosecutor for 39 years dogging the same man who's already been, you know, convicted and is in jail. That doesn't happen in real life, in normal life. This guy Murtaugh has been assigned by higher powers to sit on this case and not allow. And you can tell by the ridiculousness of his statements to the court to try to block the amicus that the Barry Scheck group had put forward, the McDonald team had put forward, etc. The wording, it's all on, you know, Catherine McDonald's website. Read it. You can see how heavy-handed and simply obscene this man can be when it comes to a violation of any sort of, let's say, duty to honor or justice. I was told by someone who's, you know, had the close conversation with James Blackburn, that Blackburn, by the way, Blackburn came out with a book. It's called Aim Out. It's amazing. He came out with a book in the early 2000 range, 2002, 2003, somewhere around there. And when you read the book, the man, you know, sees himself almost as the victim himself, the poor dear. I don't know. He was caught embezzling. He forged Judge Dupree's name on certain documents, but Judge Dupree, being his buddy, did not press charges.
Mm-hmm.
But he was caught embezzling about $250,000, I think, from clients. You know, he served all of, and this is, served all of 79 or 80 days, and even then he was being released. You know, he was just sleeping in the jail at night, and he was allowed out during the day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's obscene the way they, you know, just gave this guy a slap on the wrist. Now, who commits $250,000, totally caught, embezzlement, and gets 90 days and is on a work release program? So during the day he can go out. He was a waiter or something for a year or two. And so he goes out and does his waiter job, and then he sleeps in jail at night. Then they let him out again, and, oh, man, he just got, you know, unbelievable treatment. People here, you know, smoke some weed, get some caught with weed, and they're in jail for, all, you know, three strikes and you're out here in this state, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah. Question. During that case, now, what city did this happen in? Or what?
The crime took place in Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Okay.
Which is just outside of Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Okay. Was the coroner at that time of the military, or was it the county coroner?
Well, that's a good question. It's in the Fatal Justice book, the details of the coroner, etc. And that was one of the areas that McDonald was railroaded in, because they had a number of pictures, which were presented at trial. But what they did is they denied, the prosecution denied McDonald's team a great deal of laboratory evidence that they had in their possession that they just withheld from them. That's a no-no. You know, you're supposed to share all the evidence, and they withheld it. And it wasn't until Freedom of Information kicked in, which, if I remember right, followed the Vietnam War, so that didn't kick in the 76 or 77, something like that. And so it was only in the early 80s that they started to even get to see lab reports, which the prosecution had withheld from the defense team. And they saw how much cover-up they had of this exculpatory evidence that would have established, had it been presented to trial, would have established, you know, there was more people in the house than McDonald that night. It was clear. So, you know, the defense people, so again, I'm not sure of the answer to that, Don, so I can't really be sure. My guess is the Army was in charge. They undoubtedly probably took the body to Army medical facilities, Womack Hospitals, where Dr. Jeffrey McDonald had worked, and that's where he was operated on. He had 17 stab wounds to attend to as a result of the assault on him the night of the murder. So my guess is they probably took him to Womack first, and I presume a civilian coroner had to be called in somewhere along the line. But it's just, again, the book Fatal Justice contains the details that I'm not including in this narrative. So anyway, just to bring us back up to the current situation, the Fourth Circuit certificate of appealability, now they're going to start, I think it's within about 5 weeks from now, it's going to be in early August that they're going to start moving on this, and it's possible. Catherine McDonald told me on the phone that they're very hopeful that this latest development will open the door to establishing that prosecutorial or constitutional error had been committed in the case, and it might lead to McDonald being released. So I certainly hope that's the case. People should know the details of this case. So the official information is on her website. There are other websites that have information about McDonald and even use the McDonald case in the name, but the person who's running that websites are often really people who are acting more like as the friends of the prosecution. So you're going to get the best data at McDonald's website and the book Fatal Vision, which you can get from that's the McGinnis book. Fatal Justice is the book by Jerry Potter and Fred Boss. That's the book that people need to read because this man has been wronged more than anyone in the 20th century. Now, I understand and realize that many people have been sent to jail for their life, some executed for crimes they did not commit. So I understand that. However, this man had a right to enjoy his life, and his framers, his railroaders, many of whom have, you know, reached old age and died. Peter Kearns, for instance, has died. William Ivory's still alive. Murtaugh's still alive. Blackburn is still alive. But there's many individuals who played a role in framing him that simply, you know, arrived at the end of their lifespan and they died and, you know, they were able to enjoy the remainder of their life. This guy had done nothing more serious in breaking the law than getting a traffic ticket. He's never murdered anybody, and quite the opposite. He saved many lives when he was free to operate as a doctor. He saved many lives when in prison because he's a rather skilled doctor, and he's been spending much of his time continuing to study the art of medicine while he's been in prison. He's a very skilled diagnostician, I was told. And this man has spent, from 79 to 2009 is 30 years. He was out briefly. There was a situation around 1980 when he was out for one of his appeals had allowed him to be released from prison. And I won't go into the details how he got, you know, railroaded back into prison. You could read Fatal Justice to get the details on that. So he was out briefly for about a year, year and a half. He never fled the country, never. And from the beginning, he was never a flight risk. He always stayed there, and he faced his accuser. And the man is an honorable individual who's led an honorable and just life. He suffered a tremendous trauma of being there the night his wife and two young children were murdered. He himself almost was killed. The perpetrators thought they had left him for dead, but because they were so high on drugs, They didn't check to be sure he was unconscious when they left him. And it's really just a tremendous, tremendous miscarriage of justice that should have been, this man should have been released much earlier than now. Other individuals who had, let's say, less compelling reasons for justification, I should say, for being released, who were involved in some acts of violence, had been released. But this man is, you know, the Justice Department, particularly the Army, CIA, I guess, is determined to keep this man in prison. And it's a tremendous, tremendous miscarriage of justice that has to be resolved. This man needs to be released from prison. So I guess we'll have to limit the show's topic to the McDonald case.
Yeah.
I can see that we're getting near the end.
I feel compelled to say that obviously there's still going to be this pattern of misbehavior, if you want to call it. I mean, it goes way beyond that.
Yes.
The miscarriage of justice is being continued with intent.
Oh, definitely.
And so every instance mm-hmm. that someone participates in the contribution to that effort mm-hmm. is committing a crime constantly. You have this obstruction of justice
mm-hmm.
and the intentional withholding of information. And it's all being done to protect what? The drug trade? The illegal drug trade.
Oh, yes. And the players...
And protecting the players who profit from that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's the whole point. They that's the whole point. And that's why they, you know, Brian Murtaugh has been assigned to sit on this case, to monitor this case,
yeah.
to keep his thumb on this case. That is the only logical reason for a prosecutor to have the same case after 38, 39 years. This is... just mm-hmm. not a normal evolution of events, you know, in the normal course of, mm-hmm. of prosecutors' assignments. This is not the way it normally goes.
Now, if you were to, we're about out of time here, Ken, as
yeah.
you could presume. If you were to suggest something that people could do to help Jeffrey McDonald at this time, because, you know... sitting back and saying nothing about this certainly doesn't help.
Well,
but what would you suggest to listeners?
Well, I would suggest first go to the McDonald site and go to her documents page, and there's a great deal of valuable information there that updates you. The Fatal Justice book explained the story very well of his railroading, but that book was published in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
McDonald's, you know, defense team and his wife particularly has been posting documentation, developments in the DNA, stuff, et cetera, from 95 forward and right up to, 2009. So you're going to get the most relevant and latest information from her website, which is themcdonaldcase.org. And McDonald is spelled MacDonald, themcdonaldcase.org. And read her documentation, and then once you can see it from the documentation, you need to read Jimmy Britt's affidavit. You need to read Helena Stokely's mother's affidavit. And I have a video that Ted Gunderson made available to me. It's on my website if you want to order it. CBS 60 Minutes did an interview with Helena Stokely in May of 1983, just 7 months or so before her death. She died in January 1984. And in that, Ted Gunderson and Prince Beasley are interviewing Helena. The name I put on it is The Confession of Helena Stokely. CBS 60 Minutes never aired that tape. Why is that? Because of what she had to say. She spoke very clearly, very intelligently, and very lucidly and very... Helena Stokely was remarkable in that she had a clear mind, and she could... She had a remarkable memory, and she was intelligent. The woman was intelligent. She didn't necessarily have a great deal of formal education, but the woman was intelligent. Prince Beasley said this from the beginning. Ted Gunnison concurs with that estimate, and anyone who listens to her audio tapes or see the video can see that she's very calm and cool and able to recount events very clearly and accurately. She's a stickler for detail.
So she was very credible, is what you're saying.
Very credible. And this Judge Dupree went out of his way to try to disparage her as being... you just listen to her. And, of course, so you can get that tape from me if you wish. I plant... Now, the other... So people need to read the case and understand how... The miscarriage of justice that's taken place here. I mean, we all know the story of, if you went to school, at least in the period I went to school, you know, the famous Dreyfus case in France, in which this man was essentially railroaded by the French military to take the rap for something he was not responsible for. Well, the famous French author, Emile Zola, essentially told the whole world how he was being railroaded, you know, his book J'accuse, in which he exonerated him, and that, you know, won Dreyfus's freedom and so forth. That should have happened with McDonald, with Fatal Justice, because the book was so well done, but we're in a different world here than, you know, late 19th century France, and we have much darker characters controlling, you know, these courts and so forth, and it's just outrageous.
Yeah, well...
What...
We've done shows on that level of corruption, so we can assume if it's involving drugs that they're going to do everything they can to protect it. It's the biggest racket on the planet.
Absolutely.
Short of murdering millions of innocent people.
Mrs. McDonald is a drama teacher. This is the only way she earns money. Jeffrey McDonald has been in jail for 30 years. He hasn't been earning money. They don't have any money. And these lawyers, et cetera, you know, these guys are working pro bono, et cetera. They could use some funds in the McDonald Defense Fund. So if people have the capabilities, they certainly could use the money because it helps pay for things that they otherwise couldn't afford, you know, expert testimony, et cetera. I mean, there's a lot of costs that go into an appeals case.
So it's just the investigation on its own, you know, the reproduction of documents and those things, or, you know, the searching for documents and witnesses and all of those things.
Right. So they could certainly use
lab reports.
Because of the McGinnis book, I'll close with this. Because of the McGinnis book and all the damage he did to McDonald's reputation, starting in, you know, 1984 up to the present day, you know, there's not a lot of people who've been sending in donations because there's only someone who's looked into the case thoroughly. You have to read Fatal Justice. You have to study, you know, thank God for Ted Gunnison. He led me to the story. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been aware of it. I found out the story from him in the late 1990s. But once you actually examine... There's a ton of information that goes with this story. You examine the evidence, the testimony. You realize the monstrosity of the injustice against this man. It's simply mind-boggling. I mean, it exceeds the Dreyfus case by, you know, 1,000 miles. It's the worst case of railroading in the history of our country, I believe.
Yeah. Well, from what I've read, studied, and even my gut, you know, feeling about it, it stinks to high heaven. What else can you say?
Absolutely does. And this man, you know, this would be the good time to contact the McDonald website and, you know, send statements of support and send some money, read the documents. I mean, it'd just be wonderful. I plan to put material up on my website this week, expanding on the McDonald case, and probably I'll add some additional videos that I've acquired from Ted Gunnison and I might be able to obtain some more additional video documentation from Mrs. McDonald, and we might be offering additional info. But this could be the opportunity that McDonald team has been hoping had occurred a decade ago, but it might be bearing fruit now.
Well, I appreciate the words. Also, we can pray, certainly.
Exactly.
And the Satanists hate that. So
exactly.
So
that's very good advice, Doc.
Well, I'm sure we'll cover on your next visit. We'll cover the topic that we again had to push aside.
Okay, yeah, this was important. So
there's just so much going on. But you're on again next Tuesday, the 30th. So I'm sure we'll get into it. Mm-hmm. And we want to encourage folks to visit themcdonaldcase.org, and also Ken Adachi's site, educate-yourself.org. And I want to also take a moment and thank all the folks that have been checking out the archive of the May 29th show. That is very real. And by the way, we don't any longer have to say that an object is unidentified. In fact, we're going to start calling them identified flying objects. Mm-hmm. And so let's make that a habit, because we know exactly what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Don't we, Ken?
Yes, we do.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for being on Evident Footprints, and I look forward to your next visit again, June 30th, which is next Tuesday. You have a great week, and I'm going to say goodnight to our listening audience. You have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special guest, Ken Adachi, and yours truly, Don Nikoloff. Check out Ken's website at educate-yourself.org. If you haven't yet been to my site, go to directlightproductions.com. Lots to look at, lots to listen to, and have fun. Ken, I'm going to say goodnight, and to you and the listening audience, I better not forget this. I always thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. Seth Hendrick on the sound. And now, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join us again tomorrow evening when our special guest will be former U.S. Marine Corps soldier extraordinaire, Mr. Drew.
Well, partner, we got our pork and beans, we got our coffee, and we got this real nice campfire. Now all we need is the radio. Go get that radio so we can listen to BBS.
Gosh darn, boss, we got this here radio, but we ain't got no batteries.
Well, I told you to buy some batteries yesterday, but you forgot to buy them today.
A man can only do so many things in one day. Go into town and get some for the both of us. Go ahead, make my day. Dagnabbit, you and your BBS radio.
Hey everybody, this is your new friend, Julio, and I'm talking to you because I like to listen to BBSRadio.com. I sneak over the border every day, and I go see my girlfriend. She got a computer. Come on now, sing it, girls. Later, unless you catch me later. Bye bye now. Don't forget to listen to BBSRadio.com.